Miss Marple got up again. She was wearing her sneakers today. Not perhaps very elegant, but admirably suited to this climate, and comfortable and roomy for the feet. She moved gently round the bedroom, pausing at both of the windows, which gave out in two different directions. The hotel grounds seemed quiet and deserted. Miss Marple came back, and was standing a little uncertainly before regaining her seat, when she thought she heard a faint sound outside, like the scrape of a shoe on the loggia. She hesitated a moment, then she went to the window, pushed it a little farther open, stepped out, and turned her head back into the room as she spoke. "I shall be gone only a very short time, dear," she said. "Just back to my bungalow to see where I could possibly have put that pattern. I was so sure I had brought it with me. You'll be quite all right till I come back, won't you?" Then turning her head back, she nodded to herself. "Asleep, poor child. A good thing." She went quietly along the loggia, down the steps, and turned sharp right to the path there. Passing along between the screen of some hibiscus bushes, an observer might have been curious to see that Miss Marple veered sharply onto the flower bed, passed round to the back of the bungalow, and entered it again through the second door there. This led directly into a small room that Tim sometimes used as an unofficial office, and from that into the sitting room. Here there were wide curtains, semi-drawn to keep the room cool. Miss Marple slipped behind one of them. Then she waited. From the window here she had a good view of anyone who approached Molly's bedroom. It was some few minutes, 4 or 5, before she saw anything. The neat figure of Jackson, in his white uniform, went up the steps of the loggia. He paused for a minute at the balcony there, and then appeared to be giving a tiny discreet tap on the door of the window that was ajar. There was no response that Miss Marple could hear. Jackson looked around him, a quick, furtive glance, then he slipped inside the open doors. Miss Marple moved to the door which led directly into the bedroom. She did not go through it, but applied her eyes to the hinge. Jackson had walked into the room. He approached the bed and looked down for a minute on the sleeping girl. Then he turned away and walked not to the sitting room door, but to the far door which led into the adjoining bathroom. Miss Marple's eyebrows rose in slight surprise. She reflected a minute or two, then walked out into the passageway and into the bathroom by the other door. Jackson spun round from examining the shelf over the washbasin. He looked taken aback, which was not surprising. "Oh," he said, I didn't..."
"Mr. Jackson?" said Miss Marple in great surprise.
"I thought you'd be here somewhere," said Jackson.
"Did you want anything?" inquired Miss Marple.
"Actually," said Jackson, "I was just looking at Mrs. Kendall's brand of face cream."
Miss Marple appreciated the fact that, as Jackson was standing with a jar of face cream in his hand, he had been adroit in mentioning the fact at once.
"Nice smell," he said, wrinkling up his nose. "Fairly good stuff, as these preparations go. The cheaper brands don't suit every skin. Bring it out in a rash, as likely as not. The same thing with face powders sometimes."
"You seem to be very knowledgeable on the subject," said Miss Marple.
"Worked in the pharmaceutical line for a bit," said Jackson. "One learns to know a good deal about cosmetics there. Put stuff in a fancy jar, package it expensively, and it's astonishing what you could rook women for."
"Is that what you..."
Miss Marple broke off deliberately. "Well, no, I didn't come in here to talk about cosmetics," Jackson agreed.
"You've not had much time to think up a lie," thought Miss Marple to herself. "Let's see what you'll come out with."
"Matter of fact," said Jackson, "Mrs. Walters lent her lipstick to Mrs. Kendall the other day. I came in to get it back for her.
I tapped on the window and then I saw Mrs. Kendall was fast asleep, so I thought it would be quite all right if I just walked across into the bathroom and looked for it.
I see, said Miss Marple. And did you find it?
Jackson shook his head. Probably in one of her handbags, he said lightly. I won't bother. Mrs. Walters didn't make a point of it. She only just mentioned it casually.
He went on surveying the toilet preparations.
Doesn't have very much, does she? Ah, well, doesn't need it at her age. Good natural skin.
You must look at women with quite a different eye from ordinary men, said Miss Marple, smiling pleasantly.
Yes, I suppose various jobs do alter one's angle.
You know a good deal about drugs?
Oh, yes. Good working acquaintance with them. If you ask me, there are too many of them about nowadays. Too many tranquillizers and pep pills and miracle drugs and all the rest of it. All right if they're given on prescription, but there are too many of them you can get without prescription. Some of them can be dangerous.
I suppose so, said Miss Marple.
Yes, I suppose so. They have a great effect, you know, on behaviour. A lot of this teenage hysteria you get from time to time. It's not natural causes. The kids have been taking things. Oh, there's nothing new about it. It's been known for ages. Out in the East, not that I've ever been there, all sorts of funny things used to happen. You'd be surprised at some of the things women gave their husbands. In India, for example, in the bad old days, a young wife who married an old husband didn't want to get rid of him, I suppose, because she'd have been burnt on the funeral pyre. Or if she wasn't burnt, she'd have been treated as an outcast by the family. No catch to have been a widow in India in those days. But she could keep an elderly husband under drugs, make him semi-imbecile, give him hallucinations, drive him more or less off his head. He shook his head. Yes, lot of dirty work, he went on. And witches, you know. There's a lot of interesting things known now about witches. Why did they always confess? Why did they admit so readily that they were witches, that they'd flown on broomsticks to the witches' Sabbaths?
Torture, said Miss Marple.
Not always, said Jackson. Oh, yes, torture accounted for a lot of it, but they came out with some of those confessions almost before torture was mentioned. They didn't so much confess as boast about it. Well, they rubbed themselves with ointments, you know. Anointing, they used to call it. Some of the preparations, belladonna, atropine, all that sort of thing, if you rub them on the skin, they give you hallucinations of levitation, of flying through the air. They thought it was all genuine, poor devils. And look at the assassins, medieval people out in Syria, the Lebanon, somewhere like that. They fed them Indian hemp, gave them hallucinations of paradise and houris and endless time. They were told that that was what would happen to them after death, but to attain it they had to go and do a ritual killing. Oh, I'm not putting it in fancy language, but that's what it came to.
What it came to, said Miss Marple, is in essence the fact that people are highly credulous.
Well, yes, I suppose you could put it like that.
They believe what they're told, said Miss Marple. Yes, indeed, we are all inclined to do that, she added. Then she said, who told you these stories about India, about the doping of husbands with Datura? And she added sharply before he could answer, was it Major Palgrave?
Jackson looked slightly surprised. Well, yes, as a matter of fact, it was. He told me a lot of stories like that. Of course, most of it must have been before his time, but he seemed to know all about it.
Major Palgrave was under the impression that he knew a lot about everything, said Miss Marple. He was often inaccurate in what he told people. She shook her head thoughtfully. Major Palgrave, she said, has a lot to answer for. There was a slight sound from the adjoining bedroom. Miss Marple turned her head sharply. She went quickly out of the bathroom into the bedroom. Lucky Dyson was standing just inside the window.
I didn't think you were here, Miss Marple.
I just stepped into the bathroom for a moment,
said Miss Marple, with dignity and a faint air of Victorian reserve. In the bathroom, Jackson grinned broadly. Victorian modesty always amused him.
"I just wondered if you'd like me to sit with Molly for a bit," said Lucky.
She looked over towards the bed.
"She's asleep, isn't she?"
"I think so," said Miss Marple. "But it's really quite all right. You go and amuse yourself, my dear. I thought you'd gone on that expedition."
"I was going," said Lucky, "but I had such a filthy headache that at the last moment I cried off, so I thought I might as well make myself useful."
"That was very nice of you," said Miss Marple. She reseated herself by the bed and resumed her knitting. "But I'm quite happy here." Lucky hesitated for a moment or two, and then turned away and went out. Miss Marple waited a moment, then tiptoed back into the bathroom. But Jackson had departed, no doubt through the other door. Miss Marple picked up the jar of face cream he had been holding and slipped it into her pocket. Chapter 22. A Man in Her Life. Getting a little chat in a natural manner with Dr. Graham was not so easy as Miss Marple had hoped. She was particularly anxious not to approach him directly, since she did not want to lend undue importance to the questions that she was going to ask him. Tim was back looking after Molly, and Miss Marple had arranged that she should relieve him there during the time that dinner was served and he was needed in the dining room. He had assured her that Mrs. Dyson was quite willing to take that on, or even Mrs. Hillingdon, but Miss Marple said firmly that they were both young women who liked enjoying themselves, and that she herself preferred a light meal early, and so that would suit everybody. Tim once again thanked her warmly. Hovering rather uncertainly round the hotel and on the pathway which connected with various bungalows, among them Dr. Graham's, Miss Marple tried to plan what she was going to do next. She had a lot of confused and contradictory ideas in her head, and if there was one thing that Miss Marple did not like, it was to have confused and contradictory ideas. This whole business had started out clearly enough. Major Palgrave, with his regrettable capacity for telling stories, his indiscretion that had obviously been overheard, and the corollary, his death within 24 hours. Nothing difficult about that, thought Miss Marple. But afterwards she was forced to admit there was nothing but difficulty. Everything pointed in too many different directions at once. Once admit that you didn't believe a word that anybody had said to you, that nobody could be trusted, and that many of the persons with whom she conversed here had had regrettable resemblances to certain persons at St. Mary Mead, and where did that lead you? Her mind was increasingly focused on the victim. Someone was going to be killed, and she had the increasing feeling that she ought to know quite well who that someone was. There had been something. Something she had heard, noticed, seen. Something someone had told her that had a bearing on the case. Joan Prescott? Joan Prescott had said a lot of things about a lot of people. Scandal? Gossip? What exactly had Joan Prescott said? Gregory Dyson? Lucky? Miss Marple's mind hovered over Lucky. Lucky, she was convinced, with a certainty born of her natural suspicions, had been actively concerned in the death of Gregory Dyson's first wife. Everything pointed to it. Could it be that the predestined victim over whom she was worrying was Gregory Dyson? That Lucky intended to try her luck again with another husband, and for that reason wanted not only freedom, but the handsome inheritance that she would get as Gregory Dyson's widow. But really, said Miss Marple to herself, this is all pure conjecture. I'm being stupid. I know I am being stupid. The truth must be quite plain if one could just clear away the litter. Too much litter, that's what's the matter.
Talking to yourself, said Mr. Raphael.
Miss Marple jumped. She had not noticed his approach. Esther Walters was supporting him, and he was coming slowly down from his bungalow to the terrace.
"I really didn't notice you, Mr. Raphael."
"Your lips were moving. What's become of all this urgency of yours?"
"It's still urgent," said Miss Marple, "only I can't just see what must be perfectly plain."
"I'm glad it's as simple as that. Well, if you want any help, count on me."
He turned his head as Jackson approached them along the path.
"So, there you are, Jackson. Where the devil have you been? Never about when I want you."
"Sorry, Mr. Raphael."
Dexterously, he slipped his shoulder under Mr. Raphael's.
"Down to the terrace, sir."
"You can take me to the bar," said Mr. Raphael. "All right, Esther, you can go now and change into your evening togs. Meet me on the terrace in half an hour."
He and Jackson went off together. Mrs. Walters dropped into the chair by Miss Marple. She rubbed her arm gently.
"He seems a very light weight," she observed, "but at the moment my arm feels quite numb."
"I haven't seen you this afternoon at all, Miss Marple."
"No, I've been sitting with Molly Kendall," Miss Marple explained. "She seems really very much better."
"If you ask me, there was never very much wrong with her," said Esther Walters.
Miss Marple raised her eyebrows. Esther Walters' tone had been decidedly dry.
"You mean you think her suicide attempt?"
"I don't think there was any suicide attempt," said Esther Walters.
"I don't believe for a moment she took a real overdose, and I think Dr. Graham knows that perfectly well."
"Now you interest me very much," said Miss Marple.
"I wonder why you say that."
"Because I'm almost certain that it's the case."
"Oh, it's a thing that happens very often. It's a way, I suppose, of calling attention to oneself," went on Esther Walters.
"You'll be sorry when I'm dead," quoted Miss Marple.
"That sort of thing," agreed Esther Walters. "Though I don't think that was the motive in this particular instance. That's the sort of thing you feel like when your husband's playing you up and you're terribly fond of him."
"You don't think Molly Kendall is fond of her husband?"
"Well," said Esther Walters, "do you?"
Miss Marple considered.
"I have," she said, "more or less assumed it."
She paused a moment before adding, "Perhaps wrongly." Esther was smiling her rather wry smile.
"I've heard a little about her, you know, about the whole business."
"From Miss Prescott?"
"Oh," said Esther, "from one or two people. There's a man in the case, someone she was keen on. Her people were dead against him."
"Yes," said Miss Marple, "I did hear that. And then she married Tim. Perhaps she was fond of him in a way, but the other man didn't give up. I've wondered once or twice if he didn't actually follow her out here."
"Indeed. But who?"
"I've no idea who," said Esther, "and I should imagine that they've been very careful."
"You think she cares for this other man?"
Esther shrugged her shoulders.
"I dare say he's a bad lot," she said. "But that's very often the kind who knows how to get under a woman's skin and stay there."
"You never heard what kind of a man, what he did, anything like that?"
Esther shook her head.
"No, people hazard guesses, but you can't go by that type of thing. He may have been a married man. That may have been why her people disliked him. Or he may have been a real bad lot. Perhaps he drank. Perhaps he tangled with the law. I don't know. But she cares for him still. That I know positively."
"You've seen something? Heard something?" Miss Marple hazarded.
"I know what I'm talking about," said Esther.
Her voice was harsh and unfriendly.
"These murders," began Miss Marple.
"Can't you forget murders?" said Esther. "You've got Mr. Raphael now all tangled up in them. Can't you just let them be? You'll never find out any more, I'm sure of that."
Miss Marple looked at her.
"You think you know, don't you?" she said.
"I think I do, yes. I'm fairly sure."
"Then oughtn't you to tell what you know? Do something about it?"
"Why should I? What good would it do? I couldn't prove anything. What would happen anyway? People get let off nowadays so easily.
They call it diminished responsibility and things like that. A few years in prison and you're out again as right as rain.
Supposing, because you don't tell what you know, somebody else gets killed. Another victim.
Esther shook her head with confidence. That won't happen, she said.
You can't be sure of it.
I am sure. And in any case, I don't see who... She frowned. Anyway, she added, almost inconsequentially, perhaps it is diminished responsibility. Perhaps you can't help it. Not if you're really mentally unbalanced. Oh, I don't know. By far the best thing would be if she went off with whoever it is, then we could all forget about things.
She glanced at her watch, gave an exclamation of dismay, and got up. I must go and change.
Miss Marple sat looking at her. Pronouns, she thought, were always puzzling, and women like Esther Walters were particularly prone to strew them about haphazard. Was Esther Walters, for some reason, convinced that a woman had been responsible for the deaths of Major Palgrave and Victoria? It sounded like it. Miss Marple considered.
Ah, Miss Marple, sitting here all alone and not even knitting?
It was Dr. Graham, for whom she had sought so long and so unsuccessfully, and here he was, prepared of his own accord to sit down for a few minutes' chat. He wouldn't stay long, Miss Marple thought, because he too was bent on changing for dinner, and he usually dined fairly early. She explained that she had been sitting by Molly Kendall's bedside that afternoon. One can hardly believe she has made such a good recovery so quickly, she said.
Oh, well, said Dr. Graham, it's not very surprising. She didn't take a very heavy overdose, you know.
Oh, I understood she'd taken quite a half bottle full of tablets.
Dr. Graham was smiling indulgently.
No, he said, I don't think she took that amount. I dare say she meant to take them. Then probably at the last moment she threw half of them away. People, even when they think they want to commit suicide, often don't really want to do it. They manage not to take a full overdose. It's not always deliberate deceit. It's just the subconscious looking after itself.
Or I suppose it might be deliberate. I mean, wanting it to appear that...
Miss Marple paused.
It's possible, said Dr. Graham.
If she and Tim had had a row, for instance...
They don't have rows, you know. They seem very fond of each other. Still, I suppose it can always happen once. No, I don't think there's very much wrong with her now. She could really get up and go about as usual. Still, it's safer to keep her where she is for a day or two.
He got up, nodded cheerfully, and went off towards the hotel. Miss Marple sat where she was a little while longer. Various thoughts passed through her mind. The book under Molly's mattress. The way Molly had feigned sleep. Things Joan Prescott and later Esther Walters had said. And then she went back to the beginning of it all. To Major Palgrave. Something struggled in her mind. Something about Major Palgrave. Something that if she could only remember...
Chapter 23 The Last Day.
And the evening and the morning were the last day, said Miss Marple to herself. Then, slightly confused, she sat upright again in her chair. She had dozed off. An incredible thing to do, because the steel band was playing, and anyone who could doze off during the steel band... Well, it showed, thought Miss Marple, that she was getting used to this place. What was it she had been saying? Some quotation that she'd got wrong. Last day? First day? That's what it ought to be. This wasn't the first day. Presumably it wasn't the last day, either.
She sat upright again. The fact was that she was extremely tired. All this anxiety, this feeling of having been shamefully inadequate in some way. She remembered unpleasantly once more that queer, sly look that Molly had given her from under her half-closed eyelids. What had been going on in that girl's head? How different, thought Miss Marple, everything had seemed at first. Tim Kendall and Molly, such a natural, happy young couple. The Hillingdons, so pleasant, so well-bred, such what is called nice people. The gay, hearty extrovert Greg Dyson, and the gay, strident Lucky, talking 19 to the dozen, pleased with herself and the world. A quartet of people getting on so well together. Canon Prescott, that genial, kindly man. Joan Prescott, an acid streak in her, but a very nice woman. And nice women have their gossipy distractions. They have to know what is going on, to know when 2 and 2 make 4, and when it is possible to stretch them to 5. There was no harm in such women. Their tongues wagged, but they were kind if you were in misfortune. Mr. Raphael, a personality, a man of character, a man that you would never by any chance forget. But Miss Marple thought she knew something else about Mr. Raphael. The doctors had often given him up, so he had said, but this time, she thought, they had been more certain in their pronouncements. Mr. Raphael knew that his days were numbered. Knowing this with certainty, was there any action he might have been likely to take? Miss Marple considered the question. It might, she thought, be important. What was it exactly he had said, his voice a little too loud, a little too sure? Miss Marple was very skilful in tones of voice. She had done so much listening in her life. Mr. Raphael had been telling her something that wasn't true. Miss Marple looked around her. The night air, the soft fragrance of flowers, the tables with their little lights, the women with their pretty dresses. Evelyn in a dark indigo and white print, Lucky in a white sheath, her golden hair shining. Everybody seemed gay and full of life tonight. Even Tim Kendall was smiling. He passed her table and said, "Can't thank you enough for all you've done. Molly's practically herself again. The doc says she can get up tomorrow." Miss Marple smiled at him and said that was good hearing. She found it, however, quite an effort to smile. Decidedly, she was tired. She got up and walked slowly back to her bungalow. She would have liked to go on thinking, puzzling, trying to remember, trying to assemble various facts and words and glances, but she wasn't able to do it. The tired mind rebelled. It said, "Sleep. You've got to go to sleep." Miss Marple undressed, got into bed, read a few verses of the Thomas à Kempis, which she kept by her bed. Then she turned out the light. In the darkness, she sent up a prayer. One couldn't do everything oneself. One had to have help. "Nothing will happen tonight," she murmured, hopefully. Miss Marple woke suddenly and sat up in bed. Her heart was beating. She switched on the light and looked at the little clock by her bedside. 2 a.m. 2 a.m. and outside activity of some kind was going on. She got up, put on her dressing gown and slippers, and a woollen scarf round her head, and went out to reconnoitre. There were people moving about with torches. Among them she saw Canon Prescott, and went to him. "What's happening?" "Oh, Miss Marple, it's Mrs. Kendall. Her husband woke up, found she'd slipped out of bed and gone out. We're looking for her." He hurried on. Miss Marple walked more slowly after him. Where had Molly gone? Why? Had she planned this deliberately? Planned to slip away as soon as the guard on her was relaxed and while her husband was deep in sleep? Miss Marple thought it was probable. But why? What was the reason? Was there, as Esther Walters had so strongly hinted, some other man? If so, who could that man be? Or was there some more sinister reason? Miss Marple walked on, looking around her, peering under bushes. Then suddenly she heard a faint call.
Here! This way!
The cry had come from some little distance beyond the hotel grounds. It must be, thought Miss Marple, near the creek of water that ran down to the sea. She went in that direction as briskly as she could. There were not really so many searchers as it had seemed to her at first. Most people must still be asleep in their bungalows. She saw a place on the creek bank where there were people standing. Someone pushed past her, almost knocking her down, running in that direction. It was Tim Kendall. A minute or two later, she heard his voice cry out,
"Molly! My God, Molly!"
It was a minute or two before Miss Marple was able to join the little group. It consisted of one of the Cuban waiters, Evelyn Hillingdon, and two of the native girls. They had parted to let Tim through. Miss Marple arrived as he was bending over to look.
"Molly!"
He slowly dropped onto his knees. Miss Marple saw the girl's body clearly, lying there in the creek, her face below the level of the water, her golden hair spread over the pale green embroidered shawl that covered her shoulders. With the leaves and rushes of the creek, it seemed almost like a scene from Hamlet, with Molly as the dead Ophelia. As Tim stretched out a hand to touch her, the quiet, common-sense Miss Marple took charge and spoke sharply and authoritatively. "Don't move her, Mr. Kendall," she said. "She mustn't be moved." Tim turned a dazed face up to her.
"But I must. It's Molly. I must."
Evelyn Hillingdon touched his shoulder. "She's dead, Tim. I didn't move her, but I did feel her pulse."
"Dead?" said Tim unbelievingly. "Dead? You mean she's drowned herself?"
"I'm afraid so. It looks like it."
"But why?"
A great cry burst from the young man.
"Why? She was so happy this evening, talking about what we'd do tomorrow. Why should this terrible death wish come over her again? Why should she steal away as she did, rush out into the night, come down here and drown herself? What despair did she have? What misery? Why couldn't she tell me anything?"
"I don't know, my dear," said Evelyn gently. "I don't know."
Miss Marple said, "Somebody had better get Dr. Graham, and someone will have to telephone the police."
"The police?" Tim uttered a bitter laugh. "What good will they be?"
"The police have to be notified in a case of suicide," said Miss Marple. Tim rose slowly to his feet.
"I'll get Graham," he said heavily. "Perhaps, even now, he could do something."
He stumbled away in the direction of the hotel. Evelyn Hillingdon and Miss Marple stood side by side, looking down at the dead girl. Evelyn shook her head.
"It's too late. She's quite cold. She must have been dead at least an hour, perhaps more. What a tragedy it all is. Those two always seemed so happy. I suppose she was always unbalanced."
"No," said Miss Marple, "I don't think she was unbalanced." Evelyn looked at her curiously.
"What do you mean?"
The moon had been behind a cloud, but now it came out into the open. It shone with a luminous silvery brightness on Molly's outspread hair. Miss Marple gave a sudden ejaculation. She bent down, peering, then stretched out her hand and touched the golden head. She spoke to Evelyn Hillingdon, and her voice sounded quite different. "I think," she said, "that we had better make sure." Evelyn Hillingdon stared at her in astonishment.
"But you yourself told Tim we mustn't touch anything."
"I know, but the moon wasn't out. I hadn't seen..." Her finger pointed. Then, very gently, she touched the blonde hair and parted it so that the roots were exposed. Evelyn gave a sharp ejaculation.
"Lucky!"
And then, after a moment, she repeated,
"Not Molly! Lucky!"
Miss Marple nodded.
"Their hair was of much the same colour, but hers, of course, was dark at the roots because it was dyed."
but she's wearing Molly's shawl.
She admired it. I heard her say she was going to get one like it. Evidently she did.
So that's why we were deceived.
Evelyn broke off as she met Miss Marple's eyes watching her. Someone, said Miss Marple, will have to tell her husband. There was a moment's pause. Then Evelyn said, All right, I'll do it. She turned and walked away through the palm trees. Miss Marple remained for a moment motionless. Then she turned her head very slightly and said, Yes, Colonel Hillingdon? Edward Hillingdon came from the trees behind her to stand by her side.
You knew I was there?
You cast a shadow, said Miss Marple. They stood a moment in silence. He said, more as though he was speaking to himself, So, in the end, she played her luck too far.
You are, I think, glad that she is dead?
And that shocks you? Well, I will not deny it. I am glad she is dead.
Death is often a solution to problems.
Edward Hillingdon turned his head slowly. Miss Marple met his eyes calmly and steadfastly.
If you think...
He took a sharp step towards her. There was a sudden menace in his tone. Miss Marple said quietly, Your wife will be back with Mr. Dyson in a moment, or Mr. Kendall will be here with Dr. Graham. Edward Hillingdon relaxed. He turned back to look down at the dead woman. Miss Marple slipped away quietly. Presently her pace quickened. Just before reaching her own bungalow, she paused. It was here that she had sat that day talking to Major Palgrave. It was here that he had fumbled in his wallet, looking for the snapshot of a murderer. She remembered how he had looked up, and how his face had gone purple and red. So ugly, as Signora de Caspiero had said. He has the evil eye. The evil eye. Eye. Eye.
Chapter 24. Nemesis.
Whatever the alarms and excursions of the night, Mr. Raphael had not heard them. He was fast asleep in bed, a faint thin snore coming from his nostrils, when he was taken by the shoulders and shaken violently.
Eh? What? What the devil's this?
It's me, said Miss Marple, for once ungrammatical. Though I should put it a little more strongly than that. The Greeks, I believe, had a word for it. Nemesis, if I'm not wrong. Mr. Raphael raised himself on his pillows as far as he could. He stared at her. Miss Marple, standing there in the moonlight, her head encased in a fluffy scarf of pale pink wool, looking as unlike a figure of Nemesis as it was possible to imagine.
So, you're Nemesis, are you?
Said Mr. Raphael, after a momentary pause. I hope to be, with your help.
Do you mind telling me quite plainly what you're talking about like this in the middle of the night?
I think we may have to act quickly, very quickly. I have been foolish, extremely foolish. I ought to have known from the very beginning what this was all about. It was so simple.
What was simple, and what are you talking about?
You slept through a good deal, said Miss Marple. A body was found. We thought at first it was the body of Molly Kendall. It wasn't. It was Lucky Dyson, drowned in the creek.
Lucky, eh? Said Mr. Raphael. And drowned in the creek. Did she drown herself, or did somebody drown her?
Somebody drowned her, said Miss Marple.
I see. At least I think I see. That's what you mean by saying it's so simple, is it? Greg Dyson was always the first possibility, and he's the right one. Is that it? Is that what you're thinking? And what you're afraid of is that he may get away with it.
Miss Marple took a deep breath.
Mr. Raphael, will you trust me? We have got to stop a murder being committed.
I thought you said it had been committed.
That murder was committed in error.
Another murder may be committed any moment now. There's no time to lose. We must prevent it happening. We must go at once.
It's all very well to talk like that, said Mr. Raphael. We, you say? What do you think I can do about it? I can't even walk without help. How can you and I set about preventing a murder? You're about 100, and I'm a broken-up old crock.
I was thinking of Jackson, said Miss Marple. Jackson will do what you tell him, won't he?
He will indeed, said Mr. Raphael, especially if I add that I'll make it worth his while. Is that what you want?
Yes. Tell him to come with me, and tell him to obey any orders I give him. Mr. Raphael looked at her for about 6 seconds. Then he said,
Done. I expect I'm taking the biggest risk of my life. Well, it won't be the first one. He raised his voice. Jackson!
At the same time, he picked up the electric bell that lay beside his hand and pressed the button. Hardly 30 seconds passed before Jackson appeared through the connecting door to the adjoining room.
You called and rang, sir. Anything wrong?
He broke off, staring at Miss Marple.
Now, Jackson, do as I tell you. You will go with this lady, Miss Marple. You'll go where she takes you, and you'll do exactly as she says. You'll obey every order she gives you. Is that understood? Is that understood?
Yes, sir.
And for doing that, said Mr. Raphael, you won't be the loser. I'll make it worth your while.
Thank you, sir.
Come along, Mr. Jackson, said Miss Marple. She spoke over her shoulder to Mr. Raphael. We'll tell Mrs. Walters to come to you on our way. Get her to get you out of bed and bring you along.
Bring me along where?
To the Kendalls' bungalow, said Miss Marple. I think Molly will be coming back there. Molly came up the path from the sea. Her eyes stared fixedly ahead of her. Occasionally, under her breath, she gave a little whimper. She went up the steps of the loggia, paused a moment, then pushed open the window and walked into the bedroom. The lights were on, but the room itself was empty. Molly went across to the bed and sat down. She sat for some minutes, now and again passing her hand over her forehead and frowning. Then, after a quick, surreptitious glance round, she slipped her hand under the mattress and brought out the book that was hidden there. She bent over it, turning the pages to find what she wanted. Then she raised her head as the sound of running footsteps came from outside. With a quick, guilty movement, she pushed the book behind her back. Tim Kendall, panting and out of breath, came in and uttered a great sigh of relief at the sight of her.
Thank God! Where have you been, Molly? I've been searching everywhere for you.
I went to the creek.
You went...
He stopped.
Yes, I went to the creek, but I couldn't wait there. I couldn't. There was someone in the water, and she was dead.
You mean... Do you know, I thought it was you. I've only just found out it was Lucky.
I didn't kill her. Really, Tim, I didn't kill her. I'm sure I didn't. I mean, I'd remember if I did, wouldn't I?
Tim sank slowly down on the end of the bed.
You didn't? Are you sure of that? No, no, of course you didn't.
He fairly shouted the words.
Don't start thinking like that, Molly. Lucky drowned herself. Of course she drowned herself. Hillingdon was through with her. She went and lay down with her face in the water.
Lucky wouldn't do that. She'd never do that. But I didn't kill her. I swear I didn't.
Darling, of course you didn't.
He put his arms round her, but she pulled herself away.
I hate this place. It ought to be all sunlight. It seemed to be all sunlight, but it isn't. Instead, there's a shadow, a big black shadow, and I'm in it and I can't get out.
Her voice had risen to a shout.
Hush, Molly. For God's sake, hush.
He went into the bathroom, came back with a glass.
Look, drink this. It'll steady you.
I can't drink anything. My teeth are chattering so.
Yes, you can, darling. Sit down, here, on the bed.
He put his arm round her. He approached the glass to her lips.
There you are now. Drink it.
A voice spoke from the window.
Jackson, said Miss Marple clearly, go over, take that glass from him and hold it tightly. Be careful, he's strong and he may be pretty desperate.
There were certain points about Jackson. He was a man of training, trained to obey orders. He was a man with a great love for money, and money had been promised him by his employer, that employer being a man of stature and authority. He was also a man of extreme muscular development, heightened by his training. His not to reason why, his but to do. Swift as a flash, he had crossed the room. His hand went over the glass that Tim was holding to Molly's lips. His other arm had fastened round Tim. A quick flick of the wrist, and he had the glass. Tim turned on him wildly, but Jackson held him firmly.
"What the devil? Let go of me! Let go of me! Have you gone mad? What are you doing?"
Tim struggled violently. "Hold him, Jackson," said Miss Marple.
"What's going on? What's the matter here?"
Supported by Esther Walters, Mr. Raphael came through the window.
"You ask what's the matter," shouted Tim. "Your man's gone mad. Stark staring mad, that's what's the matter. Tell him to let go of me."
"No," said Miss Marple. Mr. Raphael turned to her.
"Speak up, Nemesis," he said. "We've got to have chapter and verse of some kind."
"I've been stupid and a fool," said Miss Marple, "but I'm not being a fool now. When the contents of that glass that he was trying to make his wife drink have been analysed, I'll wager my immortal soul that you'll find it's got a lethal dose of narcotic in it. It's the same pattern, you see, the same pattern as in Major Palgrave's story. A wife in a depressed state, and she tries to do away with herself. Husband saves her in time. Then the second time she succeeds. Yes, it's the right pattern. Major Palgrave told me the story, and he took out a snapshot, and then he looked up and saw..."
"Over your right shoulder," continued Mr. Raphael.
"No," said Miss Marple, shaking her head. "He didn't see anything over my right shoulder."
"What are you talking about? You told me..."
"I told you wrong. I was completely wrong. I was stupid beyond belief. Major Palgrave appeared to me to be looking over my right shoulder, glaring, in fact, at something. But he couldn't have seen anything because he was looking through his left eye, and his left eye was his glass eye."
"I remember. He had a glass eye," said Mr. Raphael.
"I'd forgotten, or I took it for granted. You mean he couldn't see anything?" "Of course he could see," said Miss Marple. "He could see all right, but he could only see with one eye. The eye he could see with was his right eye. And so, you see, he must have been looking at something or someone not to the right of me, but to the left of me."
"Was there anyone on the left of you?"
"Yes," said Miss Marple. "Tim Kendall and his wife were sitting not far off, sitting at a table just by a big hibiscus bush. They were doing accounts there. So you see, the Major looked up. His glass left eye was glaring over my shoulder, but what he saw with his other eye was a man sitting by a hibiscus bush, and the face was the same, only rather older, as the face in the snapshot, also by a hibiscus bush. Tim Kendall had heard the story the Major had been telling, and he saw that the Major had recognised him. So, of course, he had to kill him. Later, he had to kill the girl Victoria because she'd seen him putting a bottle of tablets in the Major's room. She didn't think anything of it at first because, of course, it was quite natural on various occasions for Tim Kendall to go into the guests' bungalows. He might have just been returning something that had been left on a restaurant table. But she thought about it, and then she asked him questions, and so he had to get rid of her. But this is the real murder, the murder he's been planning all along. He's a wife-killer, you see."
"What damn nonsense! What—"
Tim Kendall shouted. There was a sudden cry, a wild, angry cry. Esther Walters detached herself from Mr. Raphael, almost flinging him down, and rushed across the room. She pulled vainly at Jackson.
"Let go of him! Let go of him! It's not true! Not a word of it's true! Tim! Tim, darling, it's not true! You could never kill anyone! I know you couldn't! I know you wouldn't! It's that horrible girl you married! She's been telling lies about you! They're not true! None of them are true! I believe in you!" I love you and trust in you. I'll never believe a word anyone says.
Then Tim Kendall lost control of himself.
For God's sake, you damn bitch, he said. Shut up, can't you? Do you want to get me hanged? Shut up, I tell you. Shut that big, ugly mouth of yours.
Poor, silly creature, said Mr. Raphael slowly. So, that's what's been going on, is it?
Chapter 25. Miss Marple uses her imagination.
So, that's what had been going on, said Mr. Raphael.
He and Miss Marple were sitting together in a confidential manner.
She'd been having an affair with Tim Kendall, had she?
Hardly an affair, I imagine, said Miss Marple primly. It was, I think, a romantic attachment with the prospect of marriage in the future.
What, after his wife was dead?
I don't think poor Esther Walters knew that Molly was going to die, said Miss Marple. I just think she believed the story Tim Kendall told her about Molly having been in love with another man and the man having followed her here. And I think she counted on Tim's getting a divorce. I think it was all quite proper and respectable, but she was very much in love with him.
Well, that's easily understood. He was an attractive chap. But what made him go for her? Do you know that, too?
You know, don't you? Said Miss Marple.
I dare say I've got a pretty fair idea, but I don't know how you should know about it. As far as that goes, I don't see how Tim Kendall could know about it.
Well, I really think I could explain all that with a little imagination, though it would be simpler if you told me.
I'm not going to tell you, said Mr. Raphael. You tell me, since you're being so clever.
Well, it seems to me possible, said Miss Marple, that, as I have already hinted to you, your man Jackson was in the habit of taking a good snoop through your various business papers from time to time.
Perfectly possible, said Mr. Raphael. But I shouldn't have said there was anything there that could do him much good. I took care of that.
I imagine, said Miss Marple, he read your will.
Oh, I see. Yes. Yes, I did have a copy of my will along.
You told me, said Miss Marple, you told me, as Humpty Dumpty said very loud and clear, that you had not left anything to Esther Walters in your will. You had impressed that fact upon her, and also upon Jackson. It was true in Jackson's case, I should imagine. You have not left him anything, but you had left Esther Walters money, though you weren't going to let her have any inkling of the fact. Isn't that right?
Yes, it's quite right, but I don't know how you knew.
Well, it's the way you insisted on the point, said Miss Marple. I have a certain experience of the way people tell lies.
I give in, said Mr. Raphael. All right. I left Esther £50,000. It would come as a nice surprise to her when I died. I suppose that knowing this, Tim Kendall decided to exterminate his present wife with a nice dose of something or other and marry £50,000 and Esther Walters. Possibly to dispose of her also, in good time.
But how did he know she was going to have £50,000? Jackson told him, of course, said Miss Marple. They were very friendly, those two. Tim Kendall was nice to Jackson, and quite, I should imagine, without ulterior motive. But among the bits of gossip that Jackson let slip, I think Jackson told him that, unbeknownst to herself, Esther Walters was going to inherit a fat lot of money. And he may have said that he himself hoped to induce Esther Walters to marry him, though he hadn't had much success so far in taking her fancy. Yes, I think that's how it happened.
The things you imagine always seem perfectly plausible, said Mr. Raphael.
But I was stupid, said Miss Marple. Very stupid. Everything fitted in, really, you see. Tim Kendall was a very clever man, as well as being a very wicked one. He was particularly good at putting about rumours. Half the things I've been told here came from him originally, I imagine. There were stories going around about Molly wanting to marry an undesirable young man, but I rather fancy that the undesirable young man was actually Tim Kendall himself, though that wasn't the name he was using then.
Her people had heard something, perhaps that his background was rather fishy. So he put on a high indignation act, refused to be taken by Molly to be shown off to her people, and then he brewed up a little scheme with her, which they both thought great fun. She pretended to sulk and pine for him. Then a Mr. Tim Kendall turned up, primed with the names of various old friends of Molly's people, and they welcomed him with open arms, as being the sort of young man who would put the former delinquent one out of Molly's head. I'm afraid Molly and he must have laughed over it a good deal. Anyway, he married her, and with her money he bought out the people who ran this place, and they came out here. I should imagine that he ran through her money at a pretty fair rate. Then he came across Esther Walters, and he saw a nice prospect of more money.
"Why didn't he bump me off?" said Mr. Raphael.
Miss Marple coughed. "I expect he wanted to be fairly sure of Mrs. Walters first. Besides, I mean..." She stopped, a little confused.
"Besides, he realized he wouldn't have to wait long," said Mr. Raphael. "And it would clearly be better for me to die a natural death, being so rich. Deaths of millionaires are scrutinized rather carefully, aren't they? Unlike mere wives."
"Yes, you're quite right. Such a lot of lies as he told," said Miss Marple. "Look at the lies he got Molly herself to believe, putting that book on mental disorders in her way, giving her drugs which would give her dreams and hallucinations. You know, your Jackson was rather clever over that. I think he recognized certain of Molly's symptoms as being the result of drugs, and he came into the bungalow that day to potter about a bit in the bathroom. That face cream he examined, he might have got some idea from the old tales of witches rubbing themselves with ointments that had belladonna in them. Belladonna in face cream could have produced just that result. Molly would have blackouts, times she couldn't account for, dreams of flying through the air. No wonder she got frightened about herself. She had all the signs of mental illness. Jackson was on the right track. Maybe he got the idea from Major Palgrave's stories about the use of datura by Indian women on their husbands."
"Major Palgrave," said Mr. Raphael. "Really, that man!"
"He brought about his own murder," said Miss Marple. "And that poor girl Victoria's murder, and he nearly brought about Molly's murder. But he recognized a murderer, all right."
"What made you suddenly remember about his glass eye?" asked Mr. Raphael curiously.
"Something that Signora de Caspiaro said. She talked some nonsense about his being ugly and having the evil eye, and I said it was only a glass eye, and he couldn't help that poor man. And she said his eyes looked different ways. They were cross eyes, which of course they were. And she said it brought bad luck. I knew that I had heard something that day that was important. Last night, just after Lucky's death, it came to me what it was. And then I realized there was no time to waste."
"How did Tim Kendall come to kill the wrong woman?"
"Sheer chance. I think his plan was this. Having convinced everybody, and that included Molly herself, that she was mentally unbalanced, and after giving her a sizable dose of the drug he was using, he told her that between them they were going to clear up all these murder puzzles, but she had got to help him. After everyone was asleep, they would go separately and meet at an agreed spot by the creek. He said he had a very good idea who the murderer was, and they would trap him. Molly went off obediently, but she was confused and stupefied with the drug she had been given, and it slowed her up. Tim arrived there first and saw what he thought was Molly. Golden hair and pale green shawl. He came up behind her, put his hand over her mouth, and forced her down into the water and held her there."
"Nice fellow. But wouldn't it have been easier just to give her an overdose of narcotic?"
"Much easier, of course. But that might have given rise to suspicion. All narcotics and sedatives had been very carefully removed from Molly's reach, remember. And if she had got hold of a fresh supply, who was more likely to have supplied it than her husband? But if, in a fit of despair, she went out and drowned herself while her innocent husband slept, the whole thing would be a romantic tragedy, and no one would be likely to suggest that she had been drowned deliberately. Besides, added Miss Marple, murderers always find it difficult to keep things simple. They can't keep themselves from elaborating.
You seem convinced you know all there is to be known about murderers. So, you believe Tim didn't know he had killed the wrong woman?
Miss Marple shook her head. He didn't even look at her face, just hurried off as quickly as he could, let an hour elapse, then started to organize a search for her, playing the part of a distracted husband.
But what the devil was Lucky doing hanging about the creek in the middle of the night?
Miss Marple gave an embarrassed little cough.
It is possible, I think, that she was, waiting to meet someone.
Edward Hillingdon?
Oh, no, said Miss Marple. That's all over. I wondered whether, just possibly, she might have been waiting for Jackson.
Waiting for Jackson?
I have noticed her look at him once or twice, murmured Miss Marple, averting her eyes.
Mr. Raphael whistled. My tomcat Jackson! I wouldn't put it past him. Tim must have had a shock later when he found he'd killed the wrong woman.
Yes, indeed. He must have felt quite desperate. Here was Molly, alive and wandering about. And the story he'd circulated so carefully about her mental condition wouldn't stand up for a moment once she got into the hands of competent mental specialists. And once she told her damning story of his having asked her to meet him at the creek, where would Tim Kendall be? He'd only one hope, to finish off Molly as quickly as possible. Then there was a very good chance that everyone would believe that Molly, in a fit of mania, had drowned Lucky and had then, horrified by what she had done, taken her own life.
And it was then, said Mr. Raphael, that you decided to play Nemesis, eh?
He leaned back suddenly and roared with laughter.
It's a damn good joke, he said. If you knew what you looked like that night, with that fluffy pink wool all round your head, standing there and saying you were Nemesis, I'll never forget it.
Epilogue. The time had come, and Miss Marple was waiting at the airport for her plane. Quite a lot of people had come to see her off. The Hillingdons had left already. Gregory Dyson had flown to one of the other islands, and the rumour had come that he was devoting himself to an Argentinian widow. Signora de Caspiaro had returned to South America. Molly had come to see Miss Marple off. She was pale and thin, but she had weathered the shock of her discovery bravely, and with the help of one of Mr. Raphael's nominees, whom he had wired for to England, she was carrying on with the running of the hotel.
"Do you good to be busy," Mr. Raphael observed. "Keep you from thinking. Got a good thing here."
"You don't think the murders—"
"People love murders when they're all cleared up," Mr. Raphael had assured her. "You carry on, girl, and keep your heart up. Don't distrust all men because you've met one bad lot."
"You sound like Miss Marple," Molly had said. "She's always telling me Mr. Wright will come along one day."
Mr. Raphael grinned at this sentiment.
So, Molly was there, and the two Prescotts, and Mr. Raphael, of course, and Esther. An Esther who looked older and sadder, and to whom Mr. Raphael was quite often unexpectedly kind.
Jackson also was very much to the fore, pretending to be looking after Miss Marple's baggage.
He was all smiles these days, and let it be known that he had come into money. There was a hum in the sky. The plane was arriving. Things were somewhat informal here. There was no taking your place by Channel 8 or Channel 9. You just walked out from the little flower-covered pavilion onto the tarmac.
"Goodbye, darling Miss Marple," Molly kissed her.
"Goodbye. Do try and come and visit us."
Miss Prescott shook her warmly by the hand.
"It has been a great pleasure to know you," said the canon. "I second my sister's invitation most warmly."
"All the best, madam," said Jackson. "And remember, any time you want any massage free, just you send me a line and we'll make an appointment."
Only Esther Walters turned slightly away when the time came for goodbyes. Miss Marple did not force one upon her. Mr. Raphael came last. He took her hand.
"Ave Caesar, nos morituri, te salutamus," he said.
"I'm afraid," said Miss Marple, "I don't know very much Latin."
"But you understand that?"
"Yes." She said no more. She knew quite well what he was telling her. "It has been a great pleasure to know you," she said.
Then she walked across the tarmac and got into the plane.
This has been a presentation of BBC Audiobooks America. A Caribbean Mystery. A Miss Marple Mystery. Text copyright 1964 by Agatha Christie Limited, a Corion company. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2006 by BBC Audiobooks America. All rights reserved.